And you go, and this is the, no one has ever gotten out of this hole with this, with these words, but we try it every single time. I didn't mean it like that. Has that ever worked for anybody? We say it all the time. It never works. I didn't mean it like that. You know why it never works? Because it doesn't matter how you meant it. What matters is how it was perceived. People will respond in ways that they believe is a reaction to what they saw or what they understood. Perceptions can be manipulated. I don't know what the going rate for 30 seconds of Super Bowl advertising this year is. It's, what, $3 or $4 million, I suppose? Is that what it is? That's the creation of a perception. You know. And I've never, that I know of, knowingly switched my allegiance from a product, but I was tempted to switch from Progressive to Geico Insurance with the Caleb the Camel commercial. You know that one I'm talking about? Uh-oh, guess what day it is? I love that commercial. And I called up my 5-year-old granddaughter, and I said, guess what day it is? And she goes, hump day. And I've got it on video because I warned her mother. It's a prized possession. It's about the creation of perception. Advertising does it. Let me ask you this. Who would be dressed differently than you are right now if you had lunch plans today with your brand new significant other? If you haven't got one, imagine it. Or if you get an old significant other, dial back the machine. Your brand new significant other and his or her grandmother. Dressed differently at lunch than you are right now? Yeah. Meeting grandmother for the first time? You want to, you know. I kind of want this to work. And I'm guessing that grandma has a vote in the process here. We present ourselves in ways to create perceptions. Because what we perceive as real becomes real in its consequences. I'll give you a couple of examples. From an interactionist point of view, from a micro point of view, we are essentially smart people. We're astute. We think clearly. We're rational and orderly. We can pick up and learn from cues other people send us what appropriate behavior is. And we try to repeat that, especially if we're trying to create an impression on other people. We are rational, orderly. We think about things. What we do as individuals and how we do it depends completely on circumstance. It's a little bit normal. Maybe it's very normal. If by the middle of the third quarter you're watching the Super Bowl, you may be 2 or 3 beers into a pleasant little buzz. Not unusual. That may be something all of you or some of you have on the agenda for Sunday evening, right? Not normal, appropriate, and reasonable if you're in the middle of preaching a sermon on Sunday to be 2 or 3 beers into a pleasant little buzz. Not that that never happens. But circumstance, not to me, come on, don't go there. No, so you're going, hey, I want to try your church. You get the idea. Time and circumstance and context, which goes back to the very first thing I tried to tell you, the art of interpreting behavior and understanding behavior in context. That in context part involves explicitly an assessment of the context and the creation of a perception and impression. Okay? Our interaction with the world depends completely on circumstance, and we use symbols as a kind of shorthand to interact with the world. And to be perfectly candid with you, I knew in advance that the shirt I was wearing in Atlanta the other day was going to get some attention, whether anybody called that attention to me or not. And I was a little self-conscious about it, because I know these things. Now, it so happens my whole family has a whole series of Justice League shirts, because we have a very cool picture that we took at the beach a couple years ago. The kids have Robin shirts. We're all big fans of the Big Bang Theory. That's the backstory. And it just happened to be the shirt I hauled. It was my cleanest, dirty shirt that day. We use symbols to communicate. We all understand what symbols mean, more or less. Somebody in the back, I don't care who it is, yell out, "Hey, Doc, how are you doing?" What's that mean? I am A-OK, right? As long as I'm in the United States. You try that trick in the Middle East. Some of you have been there. Get what I mean? You are essentially sending the message that I believe you to be somewhat related to the north end of a southbound camel. Not so A-OK. You got to check things out. Great story. Could be true. Three guys playing golf. They're in a particular place on the golf course, and most golf courses have these, where the putting green you're using is adjacent to a street. Traffic going by. Guy's leaning over his putt. Suddenly he catches out of the corner of his eye a funeral procession. He stops. Steps back. Hand over his heart and hat off. Till the funeral procession goes by. His buddies are going, "Gosh, that was quite remarkable and respectful." He goes, "Least I could do. We were married 40 years. You know people like that. Get the idea and how out of sync it can be? We can screw this up. We can misunderstand or even create misperceptions. You can mess with people. You can, on the first day of introductory sociology, play the Star Spangled Banner and scroll flag symbols out of context. And suddenly, nobody knows what to do. I was anticipating this moment in this lecture when I did that to you. I did that unto you. Get the idea? What we perceive as real becomes real in its consequences. And that apparently was not a real enough rendition of the Star Spangled Banner to get everybody to do what everybody normally does when given just the most minimal prompting. I was standing over there. The microphone was on because I wanted the song to be recorded for the lecture. I could have said, "Please rise." And what would have everyone done? Of course. We were looking for a cue. The art of interpreting reality, symbolic interaction, in context. Get the idea? My point is that, but it's also, we do this all the time and we don't even think about it. We pick up cues, we understand what we're supposed to do, and we more or less, more of the time than not, go along and get along just fine. That's the point. And from a micro perspective, we simply slow that down and explain what's happening. Almost like we're overstating the obvious. Then, when we start looking at society from a micro perspective, and when we do that, there's the, you know, I did a whole thing for you on self and society, and there are people who make their living as sociologists examining the macro-micro link. From a micro point of view, society is more or less artificial. It's by and large convenient realities, for lack of a better word to describe it, because we create them in our minds. They're sort of convenient ways of expressing our understanding of the world around us. The healthcare system. A symbolic interactionist would understand that there is a healthcare system. But he or she would try to tease out what that means by examining the relationship and the interaction between and the rules, the organizational rules and expected mannerisms and so on between a patient and a doctor. Or between, if to understand religion and society, to understand the perceptions of, relationships with, expectations of ministers. I try to screw with that once in a while because I can. And it's interesting. It reveals things about what we never think about. And job one in this class is for you to at least have the opportunity to think about things you never otherwise think about. And then go, wait a minute, I can apply that logic to something else. And then Well, that's the sociological imagination. That's what we wake up. But by and large, on a micro level and from an interactionist point of view, society is by and large a construct of one's own mind, as it were. Let me give you some other examples and refer you to some studies. I asked you to read a piece called Negotiating a Religious Identity. Anybody look at that? Okay. It's a strange article in some ways, isn't it? I mean, everybody understands what it means to be an evangelical, it's not difficult to acquire that understanding. Conservative, Christian, evangelical, Protestant, American, and so on. You can be from another country and, you know, read in just a few paragraphs that that's typically associated with folks who have a fairly conservative view of politics, who have a very literal view of the Bible, and who take very seriously things like women should keep silence in churches, etc., etc., etc. Not to mention the allusions to or reported prohibitions against any kind of same-sex sexual activity. So Scott Thumma, who's an acquaintance of mine, we know each other through meetings, and he's a very successful sociologist. He's written a whole bunch more stuff. This was one of his first published works. And the title is so exquisitely chosen, Negotiating a Religious Identity. And then the subtitle is The Case of the Gay Evangelical. Well, my point in highlighting just those first few words of the title is to extend the logic of that and say we negotiate all of our identities. Every piece of who we are, every label we attach to ourselves, professor, parent, child, grandparent, etc., student, all of these are negotiated with the rest of the world, but more likely the few people with whom we interact in that context. I've, in effect, negotiated the relationship I have with you, which is, you know, not deep or enduring or maybe, you know, carrying a great deal of emotional attachment, but nonetheless, it's fairly structured. We're going to interact. I'm going to do most of the talking. You're going to do most of the rapt attention paying, more or less, until the class ends in early May, and then you'll go about your business, and I'll hit reboot, and we'll do this again in the fall with other people, and so on. But I have to present myself as someone who's experienced and credentialed. I don't get this job without proving that I can do it. I don't keep this job without doing it under those terms, etc., etc. You don't get to stay a student unless you hold up your end either. We negotiate all of our identities. That's why getting fired is so hard, because all of a sudden you've been ejected from the negotiation process. You know, we in a sense renegotiate our identities all the time. Married couples negotiate their family identity, and they renegotiate it if they split up, etc. The case of the gay evangelical. How did they make that work? To summarize it, Scott Thumma reports, and he does this through interviews, a bunch of guys who are gay and who grew up in evangelical Christian contexts and wanted to maintain that identity simply got together, looked at each other, and said, "This is who we are." And the other guys said, "Yeah, me too." They essentially said, "We perceive ourselves in this way, and that will be real in its consequences." Other people, well, they'll either negotiate with us and let that be, or they won't. But to paraphrase, but to quote Popeye the Sailor, we are what we are, and that's all what we are. And it took the context of group support to make that happen. How many of you, let me just poll this because it's kind of an interesting question that I generally report back to my colleagues in the Midwest because they get very different polling results on this than I do. How many of you would consider yourselves regular churchgoers, once a month or so or more in some way? Okay. At least half, probably 60%. My colleagues at Purdue will tell me that when they ask that question, 10% maybe. Anyway, for how many of you that are regular churchgoers, if the next time you went to a worship service, there was a woman either administering the sacraments or preaching the sermon, would that be out of sync for you? Okay. What traditions are we talking about here?
Catholic.
Certainly, Catholic. not allowed. There are other denominations for which that's true. Missouri Synod Lutheran would be another, and that's a strong Protestant force to be reckoned with in the Hill Country, Fredericksburg, and so on. Southern Baptist? Maybe. There are women who are heads of staff in Southern Baptist-affiliated congregations. But that's because the congregation said, we're gonna let that happen. And they are seen by other congregations and leaders in other congregations as somewhat out of step, and so on. That can be negotiated, but it doesn't happen very often. Get the idea? This is one of my favorite examples in the whole class. If I were to ask you to imagine, from a statistical point of view, what the most dangerous job that any job holder at Texas Tech University has, what would that job be? I will tell you that the mortality rate of those who have held this job in the last 20 years is 60%. 60% of those who have held this job have died doing it. Got any ideas?
Changing light bulbs at the football stadium.
Changing the light bulbs at the football stadium. Good guess. You're close, actually, closer than you think. This job is done at the football stadium.
Coach.
The coach. No, Tommy Tuberville has not died, to the great chagrin of a lot of people, I expect. Never mind. And for all of his efforts, the chancellor did not kill Mike Leach. Oh, no, that's going to be on the record. I got that recorded. Crap. And I don't have another class of this section this term that I could use that audio from. I'm going to have to put it up. I didn't say the job holder of this job was a person. Now you got it? What is it?
The horse.
I came here in 1994, and, well, there have been three horses of the five that have held that office since I've been here that have died. One died as a result of an illness. One was killed in a car wreck in the Hill Country at an appearance 10 or so years ago. And 20 years ago, and this is the most famous example of the death of the mascot, it occurred in the football stadium at the football game in front of about 30,000 people. Who knows this story? First game, 1994, I think we were playing New Mexico. And everything, and this, by the way, I must say, is the coolest entry liturgy of any football game in the country. You know, the band does this, and it's very stirring and striking, and the horse was running down the field. Everybody, I don't know if everybody does, I kind of tear up every single time. And, you know, we'll go to Raider Alley, and my wife says, I'm going to finish my, oh, no, we're going to miss the horse. Come on, let's go. Well, in this particular instance, something caught the horse's attention, and I don't mean to make light of this. I truly do not. It was horrible. The horse threw the rider at the end of the run, circled back to the southeast corner of the stadium, went up the tunnel and slipped, fell into the side of the tunnel, and just died. The horse broke its neck. And then, of course, the question was, will we ever do this again? Yeah! We would not be who we are but for this very famous, incredibly stirring, evocative and powerful representation of our collective identity. Anybody here in the band? Are you? Isn't this not just the coolest thing? What do y'all play in the band? Oh, you got the coolest instrument in the coolest band, right? And this was debated over, and there's a lot of stuff that goes into that opening liturgy, right? I mean, there's a lot of details that most people don't know, dealing both with presentation and safety and all of that, right? Anyway, I love the band. We never lose a halftime show. It took about 3 or 4 weeks. Horses are not, by nature, the kind of creature that easily does what that horse does. That is, go into an arena full of 50,000 screaming people and on command do a very powerful thing and then quickly stop doing it. You know? Temperament and training. And by the way, the masked rider this past year really had some symbiosis with that horse. He could have that horse dancing backwards, which was so cool. But anyway, they found a temporary horse to do this about 3 weeks later, something like that. They found a horse with the right temperament, had been trained, the horse had been kind of up in years, and we knew it wouldn't be the permanent replacement. We could get one in there. Here's the problem, and I'm not making this part up either. Sometimes you think, this is absolutely right. The problem with the horse is it was brown. And the masked rider rides a black horse. What to do, what to do, what to do. You know where this story is going? And I'm not kidding. They painted the horse black. They didn't use latex paint or enamel. They used a vegetable dye and so on, and it came right off. But we couldn't be who we were without the precise representation of this particular symbol, and it had to be a black horse. I'm down with that. I'm glad they did it. Who's with me? This is a big deal. It's a big deal. So that's just an example of how we do what we do because it creates a collective identity. On a probably less dramatic level, I was watching Brian Williams in the news last night, and he had on a really good-looking blue suit, and he had on an orange tie. Now, that orange tie was especially hideous, but I got the idea about blue and orange because those are my high school colors, blue and orange. And immediately, I saw Brian Williams in a blue suit and an orange tie, and I thought, Washington Park High School, Racine, Wisconsin. That was us. And we were the Park Panthers. And that was a big kind of a, yeah, Panthers, we will run you down and we'll bite you in the neck and et cetera, right? Everybody has a high school mascot, do you not? Yeah? Yell one out. The what?
Jaguar.
The Jaguar, same kind of thing. Run you down, we're fast, we're sleek, we got big teeth, and watch the heck out, right? The Spartans? Okay, I'm going to do one at a time here.
Ganders?
We will find binoculars and gaze at you from afar. I have no idea. So watch out. In other words, what else?
Mustangs.
I'm trying to think if I want to do the car or the horse. The horse, of course. Nobody's got a 64 Mustang as a mascot, although they should. It's like the classic, you know. Yeah, again, we will run you down, you know, and we'll stomp our little hooves on your head instead of bite you in the neck. Same sort of a thing. I mean, these images create ideas. Fast, fierce. I don't know about ganders. Maybe very aware and astute. I don't know. So, again, we got another one. We got a really lame one.
Rough Riders.
The Rough Riders. Well, that evokes Teddy Roosevelt, right? And again, you know, I mean, that was his deal. I don't know that I want to be a Rough Rider. I'm not interested in saddle sores, but, you know. I go with that. You know, kind of a pioneer spirit, you know, maverick and all that kind of thing. Because the Rough Riders, you of course know from your history that I've forgotten what all that was about. All I know is that Teddy Roosevelt used to bring them to the bar at the Menger Hotel in San Antonio, which is a very cool place. But anyway, one more.
The Eagles.
The Eagles? Did somebody say Eagles?
Yeah.
Okay. We will fly over you. And if we're lucky, we will swoop down and grab you in our talons, pick you up, and drop you. So unless you want to be punctured and bruised, you'll stay away from us, right? So I see you're wearing a Tech cheer and Holiday Bowl champ. You work on the sidelines, right? Pretty cool, isn't it? I go with the Masked Rider and Red Raider as about the coolest mascot around, right? You get the idea. And we embrace that, as opposed to Aggies, who we don't even care about anymore. I mean, you can always tell an Aggie, but you can't tell them much. I'll get back to my notes. Okay, I have one more. And I'm going to allude to this on, and the reason I want to talk about it for a minute, I'm going to allude to this on Thursday when I talk about research methods. You can use symbols to manipulate perception. And I'm going to get to that in just a second with Goffman. But there was a fairly clever, although I think in many ways sort of poignant, example of how to put a symbol out in the world and measure the reaction to it. This experiment, which is a way of introducing something into a context and then measuring people's reaction to it in a way that I'll describe in more detail on Thursday, a social psychologist at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, which is sort of it's in the greater San Francisco, Oakland metropolitan area, fair enough? Got about a dozen of her grad students together. Grad students make great lab rats. And said, I want the six of you here to put this bumper sticker on your car. In other words, a symbol, create a perception. The other six of you don't put the bumper sticker on. You're the control group. All of you, for the next month, take special care to pay scrupulous attention to the traffic light. Don't roll through stop signs. Don't speed. Don't make illegal turns. Make sure you completely comply to the extent possible. Every traffic law. Six cars have bumper stickers on them, six cars don't. The bumper sticker is going to be interesting, isn't it? What was on the bumper sticker? Because if this researcher thinks there's going to be something different happen to the drivers of cars with this bumper sticker, well, that's the point of the research. The bumper sticker had three words on it: Black Panther Party. Okay. Now, in 1972, those were inflammatory words anyway. But this experiment was conducted a couple of weeks after. And you know, this is not a happy story. After two Oakland police officers were killed in the line of duty, allegedly, by members of the Black Panther Party. Two dead cops, Black Panther Party chief suspect, person driving car with Black Panther bumper sticker. What happens next, do you think? They had to cut the experiment in a week. It would be like having an Al-Qaeda bumper sticker on your car now. Same thing. Get the idea? It's an example of how, to use the words of my next dead white guy, Irving Goffman, impressions can be managed. Goffman argues that not only do people perceive us in ways, not only do we perceive reality in ways, but Goffman wrote a book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And in it, he developed this concept of impression management. I did a terrible job of impression management wearing a Superman shirt in a truck stop in Llano. Not a good idea. We all pay attention to this kind of stuff because we want people to, at least if not fully accept us, at best just leave us alone, so that we at least fit into the range of more or less acceptable behavior and attribute. Goffman argued that essentially what you see now, what you see me doing now, literally, is what all of us do all the time. We put forward an act on a stage to varying degrees in the role of student, teacher, parent, child, colleague, spouse, significant other, what have you. I'm going to have three or four identities before the day is over. You know, I'm going to leave here, probably have a collegial conversation with someone. I've actually got a meeting planned between 11 and 12. About noon, I'll be home having lunch with my wife, etc. Got a couple things planned. And you get, I'm overstating the obvious, right? But more or less, in each case, Goffman argues that we do what actors do. We put on costumes, and we pick up props, and we manage the impressions others have of us. Now, Goffman argues if we have a front stage area, This is where the performance occurs. He called it the front, or the front region, where a performance occurs. We also have backstage reality, too. You can hide behind the screen. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? Because there might or might not be what is consistent with front stage. This is where politicians get into all kinds of trouble. Tea Party conservative member of the House of Representatives from Florida. Everybody's got a picture of what that is. For better or worse, doesn't matter to me. Suddenly yesterday resigns because he's a cocaine user. We didn't know that when we elected him. Probably would have thought twice if we did, right? Backstage, front stage. I would argue that everybody has a backstage. You're not going to get everything there is to know about me. There are things about me, there are things that I believe, there are things that I do, that, you know, very, very few people know about. And that's right. The people that sort of give you everything about them drive you nuts. I mean, too much information. You've heard that before? You know, we don't need too much information. We need enough information, but not too much. And then there are those that, I mean, hypocrisy is really the measure here. How far apart are front and backstage? Creeds and deeds, what you believe, what you stand for, what you do. You know, I put in an element of hypocrisy by using profane language and then claiming to be a minister. I mean, that was the intent. It was the intent to create a distance between front and backstage to make a point. And I can't say that I never use profane language. I try to minimize it, although I believe, and this is probably useful for you because I am an ordained minister and I can grant absolution. Everybody gets absolution and forgiveness for one profane word or gesture about a driver in Lubbock just because Lubbock drivers have it coming. Period. Actually, I had a conversation about this with my wife, who knows me very well and accepts me by and large for who I am, but is not a big fan of abusive language. We watch The Sopranos religiously, but only on TiVo, sort of in the middle of the day or the early evening, because she didn't want to watch it at night when the dialogue from that show, profane as it was sort of the last thing she heard when she went to sleep. That she didn't want to do that. So, you know, and then we watched Wolf of Wall Street, too. Got out of there going, whoa. Both of us did. Whoa, that was something else. But anyway, I had said something, and she said, and this is how well she knows me, she said, you know, you're very good with words. That's how you get my attention. Tell me something I'm really good at doing. I will pay attention after that. And I go, yeah. And she said, you can make your point without using those. I said, probably can. So I try, you see. But that's an element of front backstage, you see. And everybody has that. But the distance between them, Tea Party, congressman, I'm going to walk a ways before I get to cocaine user. You get the idea? I think that distance, whatever it is a useful measure of mental well-being. You know, how far are you from, you know, I mean, everybody's got a dark side. Everybody's got things about them that they work at, not necessarily trying to hide, but certainly trying to minimize the impact or damage of. I've developed a sense of humor, by and large, I believe, to a fairly sophisticated degree. But the reason for that is that humor and anger are two sides of the same coin. You know, I've had to blunt, a temper that I try to keep in check using humor. And it didn't help that, I mean, I'm not a very big person. I don't know how to fight. So instead of beating the crap out of that guy in Lano, I came up with a glib comment. Right? That was my approach. And you have to develop that. You have to work on it. You have to find out where your soft spots are and develop ways to cope with it. You have to put things into your character. And everybody has soft spots. And everybody has things that they're very good at. And you should find the one thing that you're really, really good at, and then you work at convincing somebody to pay you to do that. That's the best of all worlds, you know, etc. What we perceive as real becomes real in its consequences. A very profound and insightful sentence. because it does in fact describe quite a bit of what we do most of the time. And then just two words from Irving Goffman: impression management. Impression management. Get that, you know, just think about that for a second. And, you know, sort of candidly imagine how much of what you do is described that way. And that's a very good idea. Now, you know, there's a range. There's a range of appropriate impression management. We call it good manners. We call it socialization. On the front end, we call it BS. And on the extreme back end, we call it hypocrisy. Somewhere between complete BS and hypocrisy. That's the range you want to find in order to be a civil social creature. And I'll develop this again as the term goes forward. But that's essentially what we're about on a micro level. We know this stuff. We mostly understand what it takes to go along to get along. We understand that there are certain things you can say in a faculty meeting when you are going up for tenure. More accurately, there are certain things you can't say in a faculty meeting when you're going up for tenure that you can get away with, in fact, that need to be said if you're a tenured full professor. It's called leadership. That's how you do it. You know, you move along and establish yourself in some way that gives you the warrant, the license, or even the obligation to say things that you can't when you're a grad student or an undergrad, etc., etc. And you sort of earn the right to be more candid by establishing a reputation and developing credentials. Which isn't to say that there are not highly credentialed people running around this campus that, in my humble opinion, are completely full of hot air. And you may have met a few of them. You may think you're interacting with one now. In any case, that's the drill. That's Goffman's deal. Impression management, front stage, backstage, building on W.I. Thomas's insight that what we perceive as real becomes real in its consequences. He is in effect arguing that we manipulate perception, not in a harmful or unreasonable way. Commercial advertising does the same thing, and we will see that on steroids during the Super Bowl. And I look forward to that. I love an exquisitely done commercial. I really do. And the lame ones drive me nuts. You know, you've seen commercials where you go, holy cow, when they sat around the conference table and picked that one, what did they dismiss? Because that one is horrible, etc. You know, annoying. All right. Questions or comments to this point? Any reactions to what I've said so far? All right, let me give you another example. Goffman also wrote a book called Stigma. That was just the title of the book, Stigma. But the subtitle was really important. The subtitle was called Notes on the Management of a Spoiled Identity. He built on this impression management thing and wrote a book called Stigma, and we understand what that is. It's something that takes us out of the mainstream a little bit. Something stigmatizes us. And he wrote the book subtitled Notes on the Management, Impression Management, of a Spoiled Identity, of Wrecked Identities. Todd Radel, I think, is the congressman's name. He's going to have to do this. He is now stigmatized as a cocaine user, and he will manage this spoiled identity. Bill Clinton had to do it, managing the spoiled identity of not just president, but philanderer, and so on. Well, Goffman argues that there are several types of stigmas. There are things that are true about us through some sort of physical challenge or deformity. And by the way, all of us are a car wreck away from a wheelchair. And you know, that requires some kind of management. And in fact, the federal government has assisted in the managing of that identity by requiring ramps and curb cuts and all the rest of that stuff. The Americans with Disabilities Act was explicitly intended to help those with physical disabilities or challenges, if you wish, to manage that identity in some way. Sometimes a physical deformity can change the character of our appearance, such that it's even almost off-putting, a severe burn to the side of the face, something like that. And there are articles written and people whose stories can be easily found who have a sort of public job. One of the most, one of the most obvious that I read was an account of a realtor who'd been burned badly. And, you know, realtors encounter the public. Their job is to sell stuff. And so he had developed a way of approaching people with his quote-unquote, this is my good side, and then we're going to ease you into the rest of me. Get the idea? Well, I mean, that's how relationships work. You know, if you're on a first date with somebody, you put in the good side forward, and then if things go well, you sort of ease them into your soft spots, right? That's how it works. Goffman also argues that there are blemishes of character. There are things in people's past that can come back to haunt them. Bill Clinton got some very good advice by one of his lead attorneys that worked in the White House counsel's office, whose name is Lanny Davis. And Bill Clinton did not take that advice. And it bit him in the backside. He had to go through more. I mean, Bill Clinton has certainly recovered that spoiled identity. He's become kind of an elder statesman in the Democratic Party. But everybody knows he's a little bit full of it most of the time, you know. Anyway, Lanny Davis wrote a book recounting the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky philandering scandal. The title of the book was Tell It First, Tell It All, Tell It Yourself. In other words, get out in front of this. You tell the story, because somebody will. And you might as well seize control of it. And that's very good advice. Blemishes of character. When you screw up, and everybody does, Lanny Davis's advice, and I would invite you to just sort of keep it in the back of your head, get in front of it. Tell it first, tell it all, tell it yourself. It's going to come out. Richard Nixon's presidency was destroyed, not because a few of his minions burglarized the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate Hotel. Richard Nixon's presidency came down because of the cover-up, because they didn't get in front of it. It's the cover-up. We're a very forgiving people. Just cut the BS. Come out in front of it, and we'll get over it. We may not let it go, but we'll get over it a lot quicker. I did not have sex with that woman. Technically, this happened when a lot of you were very young children, and you may have been hustled out of the room when they were talking about some of it. You know, oral what? What's that mean? Never mind. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that level of sexual activity is, in fact, sex with that woman. But, I mean, and everybody understood that, and then when it came out later, it was just 10 times harder than it would have been if he'd gotten out in front of it. But, I mean, it is difficult to stand before, you know, people who admire you or people whose trust you've earned and say, I've betrayed that trust. And then, of course, the next question is, you know, what can I do to repair it? Maybe not much, but then you take your lumps and you move on. Some of the most compelling stories we have from anybody in our world, and not even famous people, are people who give testimonies at self-help meetings, AA, NA, and so on. This is what happened to me. This is how badly I screwed it up. And it was all on me, by the way. And this is what happened next. And there's generally a lot of people sitting in that room that have stepped in it that hard, harder, or maybe not as hard, but can learn. You know, we can learn and maybe have someone who's been there and done that repeatedly guide us through with some kind of safe passage. Get the idea? There are also tribal stigmas, according to Goffman. These are sort of guilt by association. Simply having a Middle Eastern name and trying to fly from one point to another in the United States can give you a kind of quote-unquote tribal stigma. So being gay or lesbian and so on. Being Catholic in the early 60s when John Kennedy was running for president or was president and so on. I mean, that sort of thing. Something about you that you really may or may not even be able to control that carries with it some profound social meaning. You know, and I think a lot of the antipathy that we've been taught, or that we've certainly had modeled for us, about anyone of some level of Middle Eastern descent or heritage would be a good example of what Goffman called a tribal stigma. He also said, if you're going to manage this identity, if this is something you carry, if you live with a physical deformity or have some kind of character story or blemish or defect, or if you are guilty by association, you have two jobs. You have two jobs, Kaufman argues. One, you have to deal with it. You have to cope with it yourself. You have to internally deal with the fact that this is who you are. And then you have to help other people deal with it. It's your job to make us, the rest of us, more at ease with you. That doesn't seem fair, but it is. I mean, that's the realtor that kind of eases, you know, the deformity into view. This is probably the least edifying story about me that I will ever tell in public. This is sort of dragging a backstage story out. I was teaching this class many years ago now, as it turns out. And this gives me an opportunity to tell you a little bit about one component of all of the exams in this class. There are 50 questions that deal with content, but on every test there's two extra questions. We're only going to, your score will be X number of right questions out of 50, but there are two bonus questions. In other words, if you get 45 of the content questions right and you get the two bonus questions right, you get a 47 out of 50. So it's a bump, right? Well, these questions now, I've evolved this process to the extent that these are you smarter than a fifth grader questions, which is just sort of interesting to me. So if you're smarter than a fifth grader, you can get two extra points on every test in this class. 10 years ago, I was doing what are called lateral thinking questions. That is, think outside the box for a little bit. Read the question, and there's a twist in the perception of the question. If you got that twist, you were okay. Well, the particular question, and there's only one of them. The particular lateral thinking question on this particular exam was, quote, "The seven dwarves are named Dopey, Sleepy, Happy, Doc, Grumpy, and the other two, whatever the heck they are." And then the question was, who is the tallest member of the dwarf household? What's the answer? There's a twist. What's the answer? Snow White, of course. Somebody wrote Cinderella. I thought that was pretty funny. And some people, well, Doc, because he holds himself more upright because he's at blah, blah, blah. So I'm passing out the test, knowing this question is on it. And in the front row, I suddenly remember what I forgot when I wrote the test, that one of my students was this tall. Oh, well, you live with what you do, you know. So anyway, after the test, he comes up and I go, look, I said, jump up here so I can look you in the face. I didn't do that. I said, look, I'm really sorry. I meant no offense with that last question. He goes, no problem, Doc. High five. He let me off the hook. And I'll never forget it. Because he could have gone all ballistic and postal and had a case. He really could have. And he let me off the hook because I was just galactically stupid and insensitive. So they have to help us, as it were. They have to help us, as though we're not all in this together. And that, of course, is Goffman's larger point. You know, all of us have stuff. I mean, this is, again, all of us have soft spots. They're just not so obvious. And we have to help others cope with our soft spots, either by, in some sense, you know, hiding them or turning them to humor or something like that, etc. All right. Goffman, impression management, stigma. Questions about that or anything else to this point? All right, I want to go back to that macro-micro triangle for just a second and use this as a way of getting you ready for next week's festivities. There'll be a lot of questions on the test that begin which sociological perspective. And the first thing you're going to have to decide is whether the question occurs on a macro or micro level. Which sociological perspective would examine the pluses and minuses of nationalizing healthcare? That's on the macro level, right? I mean, I'm not distinguishing those two right now. Which sociological perspective would pay attention to the subtle mannerisms by a patient and a doctor during an examination? Mike, that's a micro level. people in a room, people in an office, at most people in a building like a restaurant or a school. Face to face, that's micro level. Okay. Macro level concerns itself with issues like the impact of race, variation in income, the unemployment rate, the market share of this company or that, in this country or that. And there are two perspectives. I'll sort that out in a minute. But so those are the two macro perspectives. And then on a micro level, how do successful people use symbols and interpret meanings in order to understand each other? Things like words, necklaces, t-shirts, logos, gestures, etc. So the first thing you have to decide is whether it's a macro or a micro question. If it's a micro question, what's the answer? It will just be interactionist, that's the phrase. That's the only answer. That's the only micro perspective we're going to deal with in this class. There are others. There's exchange theory and a few others and so on. But we're only going to deal with the interactionist perspective on the micro level. So if you understand the question to be at the micro level, then you're done. The answer is interactionist. If, however, it's on the macro level, you have to pick. You have to pick one or the other of a functionalist or conflict perspective. So let me ask you this again. Which sociological perspective would examine the question of nationalizing health care, macro level, and would oppose it because it reduces efficiency and incentives? Which perspective, when examining nationalizing health care, would favor it because it reduces inequality? Okay? Which perspective, when examining nationalizing health care, would favor it because it's cost effective? Would oppose it because it simply preserves injustice rather than changes the location of the injustice. Okay. Get the idea? Okay. So you've got put this triangle in your head. There are two macro perspectives: efficiency, order, stability, consensus, inequality, gap, haves and have nots, down to people in a room interacting. Based on the meanings of symbols, tech cheer headband, Superman t-shirt, cross necklace, etc. Get the idea? Okay. There's one other little handout that puts into a narrative this picture. It also is in the same place. Which sociological perspective? It's a thought process. I don't know how you learn. If you learn visually, put the macro-micro triangle in your head. If you learn in a way that if you learn best from reading something and then sort of, you know, memorizing it or understanding it that way, then this is a 1-2-3. Which sociological perspective? Does the question refer to a macro or micro level of analysis? Macro levels are concerned with elements of culture, large groupings of people, race, gender, age, class, institutions, healthcare, education, government, economy, and so on. That's the macro level. Imagine you're looking, you're watching the news, and they're putting a map up that have different, like red state, blue state. That's an example of a macro level analysis of politics in the U.S. Okay. The micro level is concerned with individuals and how they interact. A small number of people in a restaurant, a classroom, or even a school building are interacting based on the meaning they give to symbols. We are the Mustangs, etc. If the question refers to issues at the micro level, you're done. Bubble in interactionist. If the question refers to issues at the macro level, must choose between the two. A functionalist point of view. I mean, the word function is just a fancy way of saying, is it working? Is this thing working? This thing on? This thing working? That's it. Stability, efficiency, order, consensus, building consensus. Conflict perspective concerned with issues of inequality, the gap between haves and have-nots, the wealthiest 1%, etc. Okay? Approach the test questions or even things you encounter in everyday life, and you're going to be hearing a lot of political speechifying, advertising, commercials, newspaper editorials. This will awaken and develop your sociological imagination. Okay? Questions about anything I've said today or any other time for that matter? All right, once again, we have two more presentations in this segment, Thursday on research methods, Tuesday on culture, and a week from Thursday, an exam. Thank you.